Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday. It is true crime time. And there's a lot of crime and a lot of time. Don't know where that came from. Jen, how are you?
I'm good.
A lot of crime, a lot of time. Time to talk about the crime.
A lot of crime, and I don't know if there's a lot of time, but I mean, we're certainly going to get into some stuff today. I mean, we always need more time, right?
Yeah, we do. We do. We always need more time. And so last night in the Q&A, I answered a question about Brian Laundrie. So that's kind of pretty much talked about it, I think, for 5 or 6 minutes, and there's really not much to say. But there was other news yesterday, other than the Alec Baldwin stuff, other than Brian Laundrie. We actually had a news conference about what happened to our hikers, and an actual cause of death. And like everything associated with this, it's a bunch of horse hooey. I don't believe it. Doesn't make any sense to me, but we're going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah, this is the conference that I'd been waiting for. And much like you've pointed out, okay, so it seems like they've taken the path of least resistance out of all of the ridiculous things that they came up with in the very beginning that we thought, if they go with that, they are buffoons. They have selected, I want to say, a logical outcome for these hikers. Is it the true what happened? Who knows? But I mean, they did choose a logical one. Okay. It's better than lightning, better than some of the other stuff that they've thrown out there. So I'll let you tell the audience what it is that the conference had to say.
Well, I think that you're right, that they did pick, you know, the most a plausible one, something that has some deniability, something that people go, okay, I could see that. But the cause of death for the husband and the wife and their 1-year-old daughter was hypothermia with possible dehydration due to environmental exposure. The first time in that this sheriff has ever seen it in his 20 years in Mariposa County, the only time he's ever seen anybody die of dehydration. They still haven't released a cause of death for the dog. And they're saying that, okay, they hiked approximately 6.1 miles, and the temperatures ranged from the mid-70s to about 108, which is hot. There's not much shade, granted. They only had an 85-ounce water bladder, and it was empty. And they couldn't find any other water containers. So, like you said, all the other things that they wanted to talk about, whether it's the toxic algae, the gases, what did you say, lightning strikes? I mean, they came up with everything. You know, gunshot
wounds.
They did.
The gang of snakes. Murder hornets. I mean, they ran the gamut of silly things that, I don't know, that the sheriff's department came up with as to what could have happened to these people. At the end of the day, you and I said it was going to be elements. We called it, you know, either something tragic happened to them that was experimental, an accident that came from the sky. It's been happening everywhere. Or these people just died clearly of environmental problems. They were ill prepared. I know that the audience does not like to hear that, but look, it's right here. Ill prepared. They set out with not enough water for the amount of people and the amount of hours they were going to be out there. You're always supposed to take, and I'll repeat it, more water than you could ever drink.
This is true. however, this is my one problem with it, and then you poke holes in it.
Okay.
Did they stop to rest and everybody died right there? Other than, remember, the wife, Ellen, she was further up the trail. Was she going to go get help and then come back?
Based on the diagram, because we haven't seen any type of crime scene photos, they're not going to release that because that would be disrespectful to the family. So you have the father and then the little baby. The baby is in a carrier that was strapped to him. Okay. So he sits down, perhaps per the diagram, right? He decides he needs to take a rest. He can't go any further because he's dehydrated. He's withering away. He has the dog tethered to him. Okay. A dog will normally bite a strap in half. They'll do everything they can to survive. The dog wants to survive. Somehow this dog doesn't do that. Maybe it's just old. Okay. So you have the dog, the baby, and the dog, the baby, the dog, and the husband all at each other's mercy. So they probably did perish, you know, like they're just sitting ducks. Okay. Maybe she thought she had a little oomph in her to go a little bit further and try to get help, but she's withering too. These people have had no water. They're walking uphill into the sun. I told you this is an unforgiving trail. It's not something for novice hikers. The sun's radiating off the rocks, which makes it way more hotter. than any 103 or 108 that they're reporting, that sun will get you. So she ends up collapsing just, you know, ahead of them up the hill. I don't think any of them had a prayer because they were ill prepared.
They were ill prepared. However, this is my thing. Were they all going to die in the same place? Do they all have the same body makeup? I feel like for all of them to die in the same place and then to not say any, you know, the cause of death of the dog, which seems to be, that would probably be the easiest. That.
Yes. And necropsy will tell you 10 times more than the autopsy of a human body. That's why I don't understand why it took them so long to come up with a cause of death for any one of these people, because the dog would be a very good lead. When they said we have absolutely not one clue, I was looking at them sideways because it doesn't get better than a necropsy. So the dog should have been the first indication, and they wouldn't even release what happened to him, to Oski. I mean, much less the people. But yeah, the reason they died in one spot is because you have a family that doesn't want to give up on each other. When one sat down, I imagine they all sat down and they thought, okay, we're going to try to recover together. If they had ingested something, then yeah, I absolutely understand what you're saying about, does everybody metabolize differently? Absolutely they do. You know, especially humans compared to animals. But if you're talking about, you know, people that die from elements, if the heat was striking them all at once, they don't need to metabolize, so to speak, heat. You know, it's just, it's zapping them.
I get that.
They're sitting together and they're dying together.
I just think that if you, let's say Ellen, because she got further up, she was further up the trail. I get that they're both dehydrated, but if you go without water for a certain amount of time and I go without water for a certain amount of time, our bodies are going to handle that differently. And I might be able to go much longer without water than you, or vice versa. So I just, to have them all be in the same thing. I get what you're saying about them maybe sitting down all together. I totally agree with the dad sitting with the baby, and he's been carrying the baby and he probably sat down to rest. He's got the dog with him. So he might have been in really bad shape. But then Ellen,
it's a case of where it's tough to leave your family. But like you said, not all of them should have perished at once. That's a choice. Yeah. In the fact that Ellen should have said, okay, look, I realize my family's in bad shape. I have to leave. Okay. I have to bring myself to leave everyone here. I know it's going to be hard. I have to go get help. All right. I'm the one that feels like I can go a little bit further. And just maybe that's not a judgment that she was willing to make. She did not want to leave her family. She's got this newborn. You know, they're looking around. Why did they took a baby out there to begin with? You know, you got diapers and just all this stuff, all this crap that they have to haul around, and then not enough water. It's the weirdest story ever. In the fact that you have very smart, intelligent people that they just don't prepare right and take a baby and dog out into this. I mean, it is very tragic, but it is just death by bad judgment.
Okay, we will leave it at that. I'm still, because of the fact that they're holding back, here's the thing, they're holding back the dog, and then the other thing is just the random, not random, the closing of all the parks at the same time when they figured out something. They said, oh, we should close all the parks.
Yeah,
and look,
let's talk
something
about that. You know, if they die from
dehydration.
Being overheated, okay, dehydration, overheating, all right, that's their problem, let's call it natural causes, because they did it to themselves. Okay.
Right.
So why close the parks? Why involve the CDC, the FDA, all that kind of stuff? They closed the parks after the CDC and FDA received samples of something. What was all that about if these people are, you know, came to their own demise?
Yeah. Because, you know, yes, they had said that the Forest Service had said there was toxic algae in the Merced River. Got it. And there's toxic algae where they are. Got it. Let's look at this and see if there's anything crazy. Got it. Okay. Let's close every single park in the entire state of California. What? Because maybe they'll catch on fire.
Yeah. you know, you might start a fire accidentally or, you know, by choice. And we don't want you to do that. It's just like suddenly, you know, we've always had fire season. This is nothing new. So why are you closing the parks now after these hikers were found? I don't know. I mean, I'm like you. It'll always look kinky just because of the sheer amount of things they said it could have been. And then they narrow it down to what we all knew was the most logical thing for them to say anyways. Just weird.
Yeah. And, you know, they didn't. I don't recall. They probably did, but I don't recall them saying Oh, you know, they probably died of dehydration because they had, there was an empty water bladder. Okay, done. Let's go home. They could have done that.
They should have done that in the beginning, right? And then made it a teaching story, you know, for educational purposes. Let us tell you to always bring more water than you believe that you'll use. If you're going to hike out there for one day, bring at least, you know, 4 to 7 days worth of water. And that's per person. So you have three people and a dog. They obviously didn't do that. Again, it could have been a teaching moment and they ruined it.
Yeah. The sheriff should have just come out and said, they had an empty water bladder. It looks like they probably died of dehydration or exposure. But until we get the results, that's just, you know, an opinion. And I think everybody would have been fine with that. And then you come back later and say, well, there was actually a toxic algae, or they got struck by lightning, or there was a hail of bullets or a hail of snakes or whatever. But if they knew right away that there was an empty water bladder, then I don't get it. They never came up with that. They never said that.
No, they kept feeding to the media and all the other mockingbirds. Oh, they were well prepared. No, they weren't. And this proves it right here. At the very end, they were ill prepared. They just set out on a whim and, you know, they picked the worst day to do it. So it just makes every story that was printed at ahead of this conference just junk. You know, it's just misinformation.
Okay. So, yeah, the hikers will always be hinky. The hinky hikers. Let's talk about this locked room thing that we didn't get to last week. And something and I brought it up in something I was talking about last week, and it'll come into my head why this is such a strange one to me. And it's Ellen Greenberg, and it's extremely popular. Well, it's not as popular as the one we did last week on Reddit and stuff like that, but it's popular. And I'm all for, you know, a locked room mystery. I mean, come on. Ellen Greenberg, they called her Ellie. So we'll go back and forth with Ellen and Ellie. But her parents, Joshua and Sandra Greenberg, they're settled in for the evening. They're sitting there watching some television back in 2011. And they get this news. Their daughter, who's a 27-year-old elementary school teacher, had been discovered seated on the kitchen floor inside her locked apartment with a serrated knife plunged 4 inches into her chest. Okay. Well, that sounds like it could be a suicide, right? I mean, by itself, like that, if I just stopped right there, you would say, okay, that could be a suicide. That's how they found her.
Yeah. You're thinking someone could stab themselves in the chest at least once or twice. Sure.
Sure. And in the kitchen, there was a strainer that was filled with blueberries and an orange, and they had just been sliced, possibly with that knife. And there was 2 clean knives in the sink. So that's a lot of knives out there. But one thing I forgot to tell you, Jen, at the beginning of this, with the knife in the chest, there was another 20 stab wounds with 10 alone to the back of Ellen's neck.
Okay, that changes things up. And what was the manner of death?
Well, this is the thing. It's like, it's the stabbing, right? But I mean, it's the knife into the chest, and you have all these other stab wounds, like I said, 10 on the back of the neck.
Okay. And, okay. So that cause of death, likely stab wound, since that's a lot of stabbing, but manner of death?
I think they called it a suicide.
What did they call this?
They called it a suicide.
Really? You can stab yourself in the back of the neck 20 times and it be a suicide.
Yeah.
Wow. Is it 1994?
Yeah,
is it Iran-Contra? Are we back in those days? Wow.
Yeah. So the police on the scene, they said it's a suicide. Okay. But the next day, the medical examiner said, no, it's a homicide. Then the detectives went back to work after the medical examiner called it a homicide. And they said, no, we're not changing our mind. It's a suicide. And they actually got the coroner to say, all right, it's a suicide. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Well, yes, but it's always linked to something very hinky, or, you know, a lot of cover-ups and stuff like that. You know, Danny Casolaro, we have the musician that you and I covered. I can't remember his name, where he was allegedly stabbed by his girlfriend, but then they try to say that he did it and it was a suicide. And so, yes, we've heard of this before, but you know, it's always something, I don't know, it's a gray area. If you ever plant the idea that the person was mentally unwell or suicidal in any respect at any given point in their life, okay, then it seems like these people get labeled as suicide and the police just dust their hands off and they're like, okay, that's what it is.
Yeah, and we've talked about that dozens of times, right?
Yeah.
That anytime anybody mentions the word depressed or they've had contemplations of suicide, then immediately the police go, great, we don't have to investigate it, just call it a suicide. But you can imagine her parents. They're several hours away in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and they hear it's a suicide. That's one set of emotions. Then the next day, they hear it's a homicide. That's a different set of emotions. And then to have the medical examiner come back to them and say, again, we're going to change it back to a suicide. That's a lot. And in between this, they've discovered all of the injuries and the wounds to her. And they're like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah, you don't have to be a forensic science expert to look at your loved one's body, or, you know, even if the coroner medical examiner gives you a diagram of sorts and shows you all the different injury patterns. You don't have to be, you know, in the field to realize that something doesn't add up.
Yeah. And to help them, they got Cyril Wecht and also a guy by the name of Henry Lee.
Oh, my God. Legends.
Legends. And Henry Lee, of course, was on the OJ thing. But they are experts. They got the very, very, very best. And so they just wanted to know the truth. And on the day that she died, there was a snowstorm. And Ellen taught first grade. And she got out of school early because of this storm. And she goes back to her apartment that she shared actually with her fiancé. And see, this is where I go, her fiancé, they shared it. That's kind of interesting together. And don't forget, we have this snow. She got out of school early, so we're not talking about a little bit of snow. We're talking about quite a lot of snow.
Yeah, this was a nor'easter that blew through the area.
And her boyfriend is a TV producer. And they were in their sixth floor apartment until about 4:45 p.m. And he decided he's going to go use the gym in the complex. So he doesn't have to go out or anything like that. He's actually in the gym inside the apartment complex somewhere. This is the first strange part to me. If you go work out, and I'm going to ask you because, you know, I don't work out. How long does somebody usually go work out for?
Don't look at me. I was just looking at my bank account at how much money I spend at fast food. I'm like, I need to stop eating. I don't know. Maybe an hour if they're hardcore into it.
I would think so. And, it, you know, it's inside the apartment, so it's not like he has to go anywhere or anything like that. I think if you had to go to an actual gym or something, you might stay longer. But he returns in a half an hour. So let's say it takes him 2 or 3 minutes. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt to get down to the gym, and then he works out for 20 minutes and then takes him 2 or 3 minutes to get back. That is, we're talking a very tight timeline. And anytime we have these tight timelines, she would have had to say, okay, he left. And the second he closes the door, I'm going to get started stabbing myself 20 times.
Yeah, it's like he shut the door and she stopped slicing the fruit. And she's like, yeah, now's the time. I mean, that's quite a jump in mental thoughts. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to prepare something to eat. No, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah, that's the part. She's obviously, she just cut the fruit. And he says, bye, I'm going to go down to the gym. And she goes, great. You know, have a good time. I'll see you when you get back. Great. Love you. Love you too. Shut the door. Oh, let me put down this. I'm done cutting this orange. I'm going to go over here and stab myself to death. Oh, it's not logical.
As we get into the story, I don't know if she was on any type of different mind altering meds, you know, different.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, meds for mental health that they can make you jump from one thought to another. Yeah, they can make you gravitate towards a window. If you see an eye, if you can have the inkling to do something to yourself, it, you know, much like they did to an orange. But I mean, was she on medication like that? And then also, like you said, this is such a small span of time, and it seems like he would know her mental state. You know, was she okay when he left her, or was she acting wily?
And also, you know, obviously every single commercial that you ever see for some kind of pharmaceutical product will say, oh, may cause suicidal tendencies. I mean, that's just what they say. But I think that we've become so numb to that, all the risks of every single product that's advertised on television like that, we just assume that it's going to say that, and we don't actually ever believe it.
Oh, they should believe it. If you get diagnosed with something and you're prescribed any type of psychiatric drug, I don't care what it is, you need to go Google it. You need to look at the clinical studies. They all have Wikipedias. Look at the controversies, the clinical studies, and what happened to at least 60% of the people. It's all there. They can't hide that. And then you decide if you're going to take that stuff. Okay. Everyone needs to do what's right for them. But this is the part where Wikipedia is actually your friend, because they keep up with all that stuff. And yes, that stuff is like scientifically correct, in my opinion, because it matches the medical journals that I also read. I've been reading a lot about psych drugs lately. Please pay attention to what it is that you put in your mouth.
So he comes back and he's locked out. They had a swing bar lock and it was engaged from the inside, hence our locked room mystery. And he bangs on the door but gets no response. So he tries to reach Ellen using his phone. And he sends her a bunch of texts over the space of 22 minutes, according to the investigation report. It says the first one was hello. Then open the door. Then what are you doing? Then I'm getting pissed. Then
me.
Hello. Then hello. Then you better have an excuse. Okay. See that one right there. I'm okay with hello. Open the door. What are you doing? You know, I'm getting
pissed.
You know,
you'd
write
the other
ones too.
He goes on to get pretty hot. I'm getting beep. What the beep? I mean, come on. You're trying to get back in. You're all sweaty now.
But this is the one. You better have an excuse. See, that's the one. I just like, what's he going to do if she doesn't have an excuse? Is he going to beat her?
What is he going to do to her? What if she's in the shower? What if she is doing something private? I mean, that one is like a little out there.
Yeah. And then there was one that just goes, ah, like A-H-H-H. And then he says, you have no idea. This to me, some of them, you better have an excuse and you have no idea. It seems to me like maybe they had an argument before he went to the gym.
Yeah, it seems like they had an argument and they have ongoing arguments and not the best of relationships, because he already doesn't trust her and he's only been locked out for like, I don't know, 5 minutes. Yeah. He's thinking the worst. You can tell by what he's saying to her.
So then he goes down to the lobby and speaks with the security guard, who apparently was the lone security guard that night, and he wanted him to help break the lock, but it was a bit against the policy. So he somehow manages to force open the door himself and then calls 911. And by then it was 6:30. So we had him go down to the gym at 4:45. Perhaps, like I said, a half hour, we'll give him that. 5:15 he gets back. There's text for 22 minutes, so that's 5:37.
Are there showers inside of this gym?
Probably not, because it's probably part of the apartment complex and they're just assuming you're going to go back up to your apartment.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm always leery of people who send a flurry of text messages right before they discover something that is terribly wrong as they stand on the other side of the door. And then they try to go pull a third party in, right? So he tries to get the security guard. Security guard doesn't seem like he wanted to go, or maybe doesn't go at all. He's like, no, I don't want to be a part of this. So the fiance ends up knocking down the door, but the flurry of texts, you know?
We have had this happen so many times. I'm always well reminded of the real estate one for sure, where, oh, you guys, we should go look to see what's going on. That one, there's all kinds. There's even, if you go to the Chris Cornell, you know, oh, let me go to call somebody and have them come up here and do it. It always happens. I need somebody with me when I go in there, so that way they can say that I went in there with somebody. And
exactly. They want someone to go in there and witness the horror that I imagine they know that everyone's about to see. And to me, this story is just already, I'm just looking at him sideways. I'm not convicting him from my chair, but I'm looking at him like, I mean, I've seen the story before. Why did he not just go walk it off, go get a burger, find something to do, see if she's going to come back? You know, maybe she wasn't home. Maybe she just needed a moment to herself. Why did he need to break into the house so quickly unless he knew something was up?
Yeah, that's my thing. Is the swing, you know, lock or whatever was in place. So I assume that he could tell that she was in there. However, first of all, the timeline makes no sense. The 4:45, the 30 minutes, 5:15, 22 minutes, 5:37, go down to the guard. Let's say 3 or 4 minutes, 5:40, come back up, 5:43, breaks in the door, calls 911 at 6:33. So that's 50 minutes after.
And he's texting her. So I can imagine that if he's texting her or calling her, he can hear the phone dinging or ringing on the opposite side of the door.
So he calls 911 and he was instructed to start CPR until he noticed a knife in her chest. you went in there, you looked at her, you didn't notice the knife.
How do you not notice a knife protruding out of someone's chest?
Sticking 4 inches out. And then he was instructed to stop. And then give this to the Philadelphia police. They got there fast. Because he calls 911 at 6:33 p.m. and she was pronounced dead on the scene at 6:40. So, hashtag good job, police. That part anyway. Because that is fast.
Absolutely. Really. Yeah, very commendable that they got there as quick as they did and secured the scene and realized that no intruder was involved, because it is indeed a locked door mystery. The door was locked from the inside, which means in their minds that Ellen had to have done it. They didn't see any other escape route, you know, no open windows, nothing that indicated that an assailant had exited the apartment.
Well, here's where it gets interesting. And, you know, I'm going back. I think you asked such a good question earlier about whether or not there's a shower in these apartments. And that is a really good question. And that is kind of the thing. If there's a shower there, then this really puts it into an entirely different light. But inside the apartment, police found no signs of an intruder or that Ellen tried to flee. Her body was in the kitchen, just inside the front door. So, like you said before, she should have been, you know, he would have been able to hear it go ding, ding, or whatever. With her head and neck and shoulders propped up against corner cabinets and her legs splayed out in front of her. And in her left hand was a nearly pristine white towel. Like maybe she had been holding him when she was chopping up the fruit. And looking at her hands and arms, police didn't see any wounds that might be expected if she tried to fight off an attack by someone wielding a knife. And there wouldn't be, because, you know, she got stabbed in the back.
Yeah, the thing is that if she was stabbed in the back, the neck portion first, what defense would she have had? The pain would have rendered her completely helpless, and the person would have stabbed her over and over and over again. I mean, she had no chance for recovery. Did they figure out? I mean, I don't look, medical examiners are all different. They're not all of the same caliber. Did they figure out which stab wound came first? Because if it was the neck first, then she never had a chance.
Let me tell you that is going to play a big part in this whole cover up, whatever, bad decision making by the police. And some covering up going on in the medical examiner's office too, to, I think, back up their decision to make it a suicide rather than a homicide. But so the police didn't see any wounds, right? And then there was no blood spilled beyond the kitchen, and the knife was tested later and showed only Ellen's DNA. So only hers. The lofts where they lived, the Venice lofts, had surveillance cameras at the main entrance, but none in the hallways. So were there some in the gym? I'm guessing probably not, if they only had them at the main entrance. So if there is a shower in the gym, this guy knew that he could go all the way from his apartment to the gym if he has some blood on him or whatever and take a shower.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, if there is indeed showers at this gym, if they bothered to even process the showers there. You know, forensically, did they do any type of luminol or anything just to make sure that this fiance didn't do something horrible to her? Because the knife would have had her DNA on it. She was sitting there slicing fruit for herself, preparing a meal. And then if someone came up behind her and took advantage of her lying the knife down, you know, her grabbing the towel, you know, people sling it over their shoulder, they're getting ready to prepare some other type of food. And then the assailant has on gloves. They go to pick up the knife, you know, their prints wouldn't be on it. And if she knew the assailant, which, you know, if it was a fiance or someone else that she knew, she wouldn't have been in, you know, like protection mode, so to speak. So again, she would have never had a prayer.
No. And the neighbors told police that aside from Goldberg, the fiance, banging on the door, there had been no sounds of a disturbance. And don't forget that the police right away, when they saw that it had been locked from the inside, suicide. So they didn't really have a reason to go down to the showers because they just said, oh, it's a suicide. Let's get out of here. Let's go home. There's a snowstorm. We got a lot of accidents and stuff like that to do. And let's just, you know, wrap this up. And they had a balcony. This unit had a balcony, but because of the snow, they could tell that nobody had been there because the snow was undisturbed. So we really do have something that's locked room. And the homicide sergeant said everything happened right where she was and that the rest of the apartment was pretty unremarkable.
I understand the balcony situation. Again, that door was locked and the snow would have told if anyone had stepped there, because a nor'easter, this is feet of snow. So if someone had been stepping there, the prints would have been left. The entry and exit is going to be the front door. And the boyfriend conveniently goes to the jail, to the gym and works out. You know, how convenient. And, you know, she probably had, she had her whole life to do this to herself, but she waits until he goes to the gym to do it.
She waits until he's slicing berries
or whatever.
And if they've been together for as long as they've been together and they're engaged, she probably knows how long he goes to the gym for. So she's going, you know, he's going to the gym right now. He's only been going 20 minutes. Do you think I can kill myself in the 20 minutes? Do you think I can stab myself enough to kill myself in these 20 minutes that he's going to be gone?
20 times in the neck, though? I mean, it just makes me wonder what their conversation was like before he exited, because a lot of people work out when they're angry. They want to blow off steam. They replace it for something else they've abandoned. Like when people give up substance abuse or cigarettes or stuff like that, they'll replace it with working out in the gym. So I just wonder if he took off because he needed to blow off some steam and if she wasn't bothered by the conversation that they had. Again, are these two people that are going to break up? Are they leaving each other? You know, conversation and context and all that is so important here.
It is. So the police said, hey, he remained on scene. He was cooperative. There was no signs of an intruder because the apartment door had been locked until it was broken in by him. Hey, there's no defensive wounds. So this is suicide, guys. Let's wrap it up. Now, investigators, this is an important note. Investigators looked at Ellen's laptop computers, found nothing indicative of suicide, and she didn't leave behind a note. Well, she wouldn't have had time to leave behind a note because she only had 20 minutes. But I want you to remember about the part where they looked at the laptop and found nothing indicative of suicide, because that's going to come back up. So the day after the death, they start doing the autopsy, and he's doing he starts labeling the stab wounds with letters beginning with A, and he stopped at T. So that shows you. I mean, the letter A ends at T. 8 wounds to the chest. So you're much better at this part than me. So the punctures are just 0.2 centimeters deep. So that's kind of, are those maybe what the getting, you know, the hesitation ones or whatever?
Yeah,
and then
people will normally start off with a lot of hesitation marks because they're gauging pain. You know, do I really want to do this? You know, they do it a couple of times. Yeah, that hurts. And then finally they build up the will to go deeper. So you have these 2-inch stab wounds and then it becomes 2.5 and then, you know, that one that's 4 at least.
Yeah. So the 0.2 centimeters all the way to the 4-inch, there's a 2-inch stab wound to her stomach, a 2.5-inch long gash across her scalp. Very interesting place to have one. 10 wounds from nicks to 2 about 3 inches deep on the back of her neck. And then there were 11 bruises in various stages of resolution on her right arm, her abdomen, and her right leg. And the guy looks at it, the assistant medical examiner goes, homicide. You know, what else is he going to think? If you're just presented with this body, of course you're going to say it's murder, because all the things on the back of her neck,
she's got stab wounds basically all over her body. You would not be able to sustain the pain. Okay. She's not a Green Beret. This is just a girl. She's not going to be able to sustain the pain to keep stabbing herself over and over again in all these weird places. I mean, try to put your hand behind your neck and pretend like you're stabbing yourself 20 times. That's weird after you've already stabbed yourself, what, in the front? I mean, to me, it's indicative of someone trying to move away from someone. I would like to see the crime scene pictures. On top of that, the medical examiner has her on the table and realizes she's got 11 bruises in various stages of healing, which you wonder how she got those bruises. Did she do it to herself, or was she a battered woman?
And also think about a 4-inch deep. So when you're trying to put your hand behind your neck and trying to stab yourself, you need to go and pull your hand, your arm back far enough for this 4-inch long blade with the handle. And then you start stabbing yourself in the back, and then you cut yourself on the scalp. I mean, now here's where this is interesting, is that when at the funeral, actually, when the dad is eulogizing his daughter, he says, "You may have heard that Ellen killed herself, but her death has just been ruled a homicide." So the room goes silent. And because of that, all of a sudden the homicide unit gets involved. But we're already at her funeral. The police have already said it's a suicide. Everything is all messed up. All the records, anything like that. So the investigators, they come and they look at Goldberg's key fob. Record. So apparently, I guess you probably needed to touch it. It's kind of, you know, like you got a card or whatever and you touch the key fob and it opens. And then they looked at security videos, but there's no security videos at all in the hall. All the videos were just showing access of entrances by anyone around the time of Ellen's death. So I have no doubt that if you look at the key fob records and it says, "I went to the gym." All right, let's see. Okay, you're right. He went to the gym at 4:45 because his key fob said. But if there's not a key fob to get into the shower.
I mean, that's the thing. Yeah, the whole, did you go to the gym to really work out or did you go to clean up is a huge question.
Because it's just not, obviously he could just, oh, you know, I need a quick 20-minute, you know, treadmill or something like that. I mean, it's possible. So then the police, they're digging around and then we get to January 29th, and the police said, yeah, despite the homicide ruling, we're kind of leaning towards a suicide. And then looking into, quote-unquote, mental issues she might have had. Well, where do you learn about the mental issues? They actually got it from the parents. And probably the boyfriend, too. And once you start doing that, like you said, even with the most glaringly obvious, how did she ever do those kind of wounds? They're going to go with suicide.
Yeah, they've become biased to what the family is telling them. Yeah, the person was depressed. They had, you know, just all these different bouts of suicidal thoughts, whatnot. If you ever plant that seed, it will grow. And it seems like that's what happened to her.
A month or two before her death, Ellen had a marked change in demeanor. And her parents watched as she became unsettled and anxious. And when they asked what was wrong, she would only say she was stressed out about her job. Now, they did not live particularly close. So I wonder how often, if it was just one weekend that had happened. Did they notice it? Did they FaceTime a lot? Something like that. It's 2011, so there's probably not a lot of FaceTime. But they could have talked on the computer or something. And the mom said, you know, I was just trying to figure out everything I could. Why is she acting like this? I just thought she felt overwhelmed. And one of her best friends said that Ellen went from being one of the happiest people I knew to filled with anxiety. And even the best friend said she kept saying it was because of school and she was vague about everything. So maybe something was going on at school. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to figure out what was going on in her life. Was it school? Was it work? Was it the fiance that she lived with? I mean, something was bothering her. If you have someone in front of you on the FaceTime video chat or whatever, and you look at them and you say, "What is wrong with you?" And they said, there would just be a long silence. She would stare back at you and she didn't want to talk about it. That is someone that's really having something bad done to them. It's bothering them. She was probably up at night. You know, these thoughts never left her. You know, did someone attack her, though, or was it enough for her to end her own life?
Well, here's what I'm thinking about a couple of things on this. Because also, if you're having a conversation and the boyfriend's next to you, you can't say it's because of the boyfriend. The natural response to anybody in this question is going to say, oh, it's just work. Because that's acceptable. That's plausible, going back to our hikers. You can always say you're stressed out about work because everybody can relate to that. Oh, that's certainly a plausible explanation. And then there was a teacher that taught school with Ellen. And she goes, well, you know, Ellen had some tough kids in her class, but we all do. And she didn't seem any more stressed than the other teachers. So it's different. The teachers are going, well, they would know if there was some kind of, you know, crazy thing going on at school. And also this person, this other teacher would see Ellen every single day and just, and would know, okay, no, it's the same kind of stress level. So that is that I thought that was interesting. And then I thought what was more interesting is she asked her parents if she could move back home.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, so I take teaching off the table. There would have been a disciplinary action record if she was having a problem with a student or something like that. We moved more towards her wanting to move back in with her parents and the fact that she had an impending marriage in August. And I think about this impending marriage and her potentially marrying someone that could have allegedly put those bruises on her. The medical examiner is looking at her again on this table. He sees all these bruises in different states of resolution. You know, bruises go through a series of healing patterns. They turn black and blue, then it's green, yellow. He's looking at this. Who's putting those bruises on her? You know, is this a woman who's trying to escape a relationship that she realizes is a huge mistake? You know, imagine if you go on to marry this guy. It's tougher to get away from someone if you marry them.
Yeah, and like I said, this is not a place, if she goes to move back home, it's not a place where she's going to be able to keep her job in Philadelphia. So she is, can I move back home? And they thought it was strange because she was supposed to get married, 7 months later. But the daughter said, no, it has nothing to do with her fiance. Well, then that makes no sense. And the dad said she didn't ever complain about anybody or anything except that she wanted to come home. Because she probably felt safe there.
Yeah, and she felt safe. And also maybe she didn't want to say anything about her fiance openly because she feared that information would get back to him and make it 10 times worse on her. Or she didn't want people to think bad of him because then some people will judge you and say, well, you just made a poor choice in partnership. You know, you know how to pick them. People will pick on you like that. So maybe she just took a private route and thought, if I just move back home and I don't say anything about anyone, it's better this way.
So now that's, we think, okay, well, that argument's leading us to perhaps it's the fiance. But the parents say, hey, why don't you go see a psychiatrist that we know? So Ellen goes and has 3 appointments with a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist actually talked because of the fact that Ellen's dead. So the privilege can be waived. And Ellen felt overwhelmed at work, is what the psychiatrist said. But there was never any feelings of suicidal thoughts and that she had nothing but good things to say about her fiance. And that the psychiatrist even said, oh, she even smiled when she spoke about him. And the psychiatrist asked about abuse and Ellen denied any verbal or physical confrontations.
Yeah, but so did Gabby Petito. This is what they do. You know, they don't even realize they are victims. They will protect their lover. They'll go to the end of the earth doing as much. You know, they either don't realize that something terrible is happening to them or they don't want to admit it because it's just too embarrassing. The next question is, why do you allow it to happen? Or why don't you leave? People don't want to go through that. You know, there's a multitude of reasons of why people don't get out of bad relationships. And, you know, this society has stigmatized it so bad to where people won't even admit anymore that something's happening because people come down so hard on them. Why didn't you leave? There's reasons, people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, maybe she just didn't mention it to the psychiatrist because she knew where it would go.
So the psychiatrist described Ellen as having severe anxiety and prescribed her the anti-anxiety drug, Klonopin and Ambien. Those don't sound like they go together very well.
No. Opinion, no.
They were the drugs found in Ellen's system when she died. And the psychiatrist last saw Ellen on January 19th, and 3 days later, Ellen had her last communication with many of her loved ones, which she sent out save the date cards for her wedding. And that was, you know, basically 4 days before her death. So.
Okay. So started new anti-anxiety drugs, a combination, and then possibly hurts herself.
Yeah. So, I mean, that, we, you know, and both of those say that you can have suicidal thoughts when you're taking them, both of them. So, and she'd never taken them before. And, well, I guess, well, she'd probably taken them for a few weeks because she had seen the psychiatrist for three times, but not for very long. And often, don't you have to kind of adjust the amount you're taking, and there's like a process to figure out exactly how much you should be taking?
Absolutely. I don't worry so much about the Klonopin. The Ambien has a lot of warnings to it. You can do things and not remember. People have baked entire cakes. They have drove places at night, and they have no recollection of doing it. A lot of people are drawn to windows. It runs the gamut of bad side effects. So, yeah, you should be monitored while you're on it. And I wonder if she was reporting back to the psychiatrist how she was feeling, or, you know, was she taking the medicine as directed at all? I mean, we just don't know. Maybe she filled it and didn't take it. It's a gray area. I tend to think that she probably did based on what happened and, you know.
Yeah. All right. So we had the suicide, then we had a homicide. Now we're calling it a suicide. But you had a homicide sergeant who, you know, was investigating, a guy named Detective John McNamee. And they all went through it. And they go, okay, you know, we got the locked apartment. She was anxious. No evidence of a struggle. No other person's DNA. The hesitation wounds. No marks on her body that indicated she fought with an attacker, although the bruising maybe. But so he says what we should do is we should hire an outside neuropathologist to review a portion of Ellen's spinal cord. Let's see if it was damaged by any of the wounds to the back of her neck. Because if it was, then she would have been incapacitated and unable to do all of the subsequent wounds, right? She would have been paralyzed. So according to the detective, that's important. The neuropathologist conducted the exam, told police that the spinal cord sheath was hit, but the cord was not severed. She most likely went numb, thus allowing her to stab herself repeatedly. And then, you know, it was in March that they changed it back to a suicide. And the parents, of course, are like, oh my gosh. You know, we thought she was murdered. Now you're saying, you know, that she was, it was a suicide. And that's when they decided to hire, Wecht and, Henry Lee.
Yeah, I don't blame them. I would have hired my own forensic pathologist as well, because still, even though I agree that the detective's looking at the locked room and just different forensic aspects, you know, I want to know what her toxicology looked like and things like that. And then the fiance's not in the locked room with her. They said they're just letting things go where they went, and they're just following the trail, and that's where it took them. So they felt satisfied that it's a suicide. But if you have someone clever enough to set all of this up, I mean, it would be the perfect murder.
Yeah. And Wecht, by the way, he's the pathologist who famously challenged the single bullet theory of the John F. Kennedy assassination. So he had concerns about the number and location of the stab wounds, and especially, of course, the ones to the back of Ellen's neck. And he said, I don't understand how they just wrote this off as a suicide. There is a crime-solving club in Philadelphia. I'm not going to pronounce it right. I think it's called the Vidocq Society. And it's VIDOCQ. So somebody help me with that later.
Vidocq.
Okay. So they said that the lack of defensive wounds on Ellen doesn't support suicide necessarily, because there's a lot of stabbing victims without defensive wounds, especially if you don't see them coming.
That's the thing. I mean, if they had been anywhere other than the back of her neck, I would have been on board with what the homicide detectives are saying. But that many stab wounds in such an odd place on the body. I mean, this woman must have had just a very strong threshold for pain, you know, because the neck is supposedly not where she got started. It's right where she ended. So, I mean, how do you keep doing that to yourself? She would have needed to make her way to the back in order to not hurt her spinal cord, but to render herself numb enough to keep going. But then again, I wonder, you know, those nerves are also hooked to your dominant arm. So how did she continue to do the stabbing with the dominant arm and not have that arm give out?
And also never let go of the clean towel in the left hand. That's the other thing, right? Just never let it go. And so they said, you know, there's blitz attacks where the victims attack so quickly they can't defend themselves. And the other thing that nagged at this detective from the society is that images of Ellen at the scene show a stream of dried blood running horizontally across her cheek from the side of her nose toward her left ear. But her body was slumped upright when found. So,
somebody moved her.
Yep, because police theorized that she stabbed herself while standing and slid seated to the floor. I get that. I could see why they would say that. And that her body was never moved. But Brennan says, how then are you going to explain the horizontal stream of blood on her cheek? And a Philadelphia homicide detective, a retired one, who's in private practice as a detective, and he also worked in the DA's office, and he looked at the case file in 2015, and he said the blood path defies gravity. You don't need to be a pathologist to have an appreciation for that. Either she moved herself or someone moved her. I just can see that blood.
Someone that takes a white pristine towel and throws it over their shoulder or has it in their hand, do you believe that person is prepared to make a big old bloody scene? Does that seem like that their thought process is heading towards mass murder, mass blood going everywhere? I mean, to me, she wouldn't have had that even in the vicinity if she thought that she was going to start hacking herself up. To me, that's a woman that doesn't want to make a mess. You know, she's preparing a meal for herself. She's got this clean towel in case she messes up. The whole moving away, you know, the like blood pattern tells a story. That's why I just think like seeing the crime scene photos are everything. You know, we're not there. So it's hard to come up with a good opinion that is as good as these pathologists that have studied it because we haven't seen it. But anytime that you have a horizontal pattern of blood that doesn't match the vertical pattern of how the body was found when it just was lying in rest and supposedly nobody was, you know, touched the body once it came to a rest. I question if the boyfriend, fiance, whatever he is, was inside of those doors before they were locked. And if these two didn't get into it because she's moved. I mean, the blood pattern shows that she was moved, you know, and some of the stab wounds with them being from 2 inches deep, going into 2.5 and going into 4 is indicative of someone maybe trying to move away from someone, you know, like maybe trying to ration with them, you know, like, hey, can you stop stabbing me or whatever? Maybe she didn't use her hands. Not all women do. Not all women block with hands.
Yeah. And remember I said earlier about the detective said that he had talked to a neuropathologist and had them investigate. Well, there's this question. So just a single line about the spinal cord exam appears in Ellen's autopsy report. It says, note, neuropathologist Dr. Lucy Rourke, but they didn't spell it with the R, examined the spinal cord and concluded there is no defect of the spinal cord. And the reference was to a pathologist named Lucy Rourke Adams, who's renowned and who retired from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in 2015. And so this former homicide detective who's looking through the file in 2015 said he couldn't find the neuropathology report. So he requested a copy from the police and the medical examiner's office, but was told it couldn't be found or didn't exist. And an invoice couldn't be found either. So people reached out to Rourke Adams, and in an email, she confirmed that she did do contract work for the medical examiner's office in 2011. But she said, I would conclude because there's not a report or a bill that I did not see the specimen in question, although there is a remote possibility that it was shown to me. However, I have no recollection of such a case. Okay. This is somebody who's renowned. So the detective knows that. Somebody makes a little line in the thing and thinking, oh, well, nobody's ever going to check because this is suicide. This is somebody who was really well known and she doesn't remember. And believe me, I think despite how many cases and dead bodies she saw, she probably would remember something that is so interesting where somebody stabbed in the back and in the front and it's called a suicide.
Yeah, not only that, she would remember it just because it was so sketchy and multiple people were asking questions about it, but they remember the majority of their cases, whether they're interesting or not. That's just what medical examiners and pathologists do, and especially neurologists. They keep up with all that stuff. They keep up with whether they're deceased or living, they keep up with their patients.
Yeah, because also, a lot of these medical examiners are going to have to go to court. So they probably remember a lot about a lot of cases. And
well, they file the information, you know, so they can use it later. You know, if this comes up again, they can use what they learned from this case in another case. You know, oh, I've seen this before because I worked on so-and-so's, let's just call it pathology, you know.
Yeah. And so this guy, Brennan, the one who was part of the society, he made a discovery. There was a piece of Ellen's spinal cord that was still kept in storage at the medical examiner's office. So he contracted with this guy named Wayne Ross, who's a forensic pathologist for several counties to examine the specimen. And he concluded that one of the stab wounds penetrated Ellen's cranial cavity and severed the cranial nerves and brain. And he did this in a 2017 report and said as a result, she would experience severe pain and impaired loss of consciousness. And then Henry Lee said the number and types of wounds and bloodstain patterns observed are consistent with a homicide scene.
See, I mean that, and I hope I'm saying it correctly. This is how I've always heard it. The Vidoc Society is incredible at what they do. They don't even get like enough funding because they have basically solved a lot of stuff and also gave people just tremendously good leads. They're incredible. The thing here is that she was on Klonopin, right, which already slows your judgment. You're not going to be as sharp as you used to be. So her actions are already going to be delayed. Again, I would like to see her talks. On top of that, if she had anything severed cranial-wise, spinal-wise, she's already not able to respond, which is likely how she was continuously stabbed over and over and over again. But all of this still leads to her not being able to do it to herself.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things also that kind of is strange a little bit is that the search history from Ellen's computer, they looked at it. They wanted to look at it from December 18th, 2010 and January 10th, 2011. And so it was recovered by the Regional Computer Forensics Laboratory and turned over to police, but not till April 1st, 2011. And it included the search terms suicide methods, quick suicide, and painless suicide. And some of Ellen's text messages were provided as well. And on January 8th, so this is basically, I guess, when she started the medicine. Because she said, I'm starting the med. I know you don't understand, but I can't keep living with feeling this way. Ellen texted her mom. So that was January 8th. And then 9 days later, she texted her mom, Klonopin helped, thank God. And mom wrote back, so happy for you. And she goes, me too. OMG. So it seems like everything's okay.
Yeah, if she sent this text, I want to know if she, you know, because they give us the context of how the spelling was, and she leaves out certain letters like thank God is T-H-N-K. Is that how she normally types? You know, I just want to make sure she's the one sending these. And was she taking the Klonopin as directed? Because some people will, I hate to say it, abuse the Klonopin and Xanax because, yes, it works. It works a little too well. So they'll take more than what is designated to be prescribed. And had she finished the bottle, you know, could that have been why she flipped out? You know, if you run out of something like that, you're no longer feeling balanced or good. That's important to the story, too. You know, I look at the fiance, but then I have to look at her, too. And I just want to know where she was at in these prescription bottles.
Right. And the day before her death, the mom texted Ellen and said, you need to see a professional. And Ellen replied, okay, I'm trying, just scared a bit for everything. Well,
what was she scared of?
And wasn't she already seeing a professional?
Yeah, I thought in order for her to get the Klonopin and the Ambien, that was prescribed by a psychiatrist. So what was the context? Did they have a conversation by phone that we missed to where, you know, then these texts came after about her mother saying you need to see a different professional?
Yeah, and this is, so then you got this just, okay, it's suicide. And then the attorney general closed the investigation. But the attorney general was asked why the medical examiner's report said nothing indicative of suicide had been found on Ellen's computer. Because remember way back at the beginning, I said, hey, they checked the computer and it was clean. So all of a sudden.
A clean computer, right? And then a psychiatrist that does not diagnose her with psychosis or any type of psychotic mental break. He said that she seemed okay.
Yeah. So, okay. There was nothing on the computer. The investigators found nothing. And then after she dies, but before the investigators take the computer, all of a sudden there's something in there that says, oh, quick suicide, painless suicide. Because, you know, when you stab yourself 20 times, that's entirely painless. And so then they also couldn't explain, you know, why there was different reports in there. And they couldn't, the DA didn't know if police or prosecutor ever looked at it. And then they asked again about the neuropathology exam and the doctor having no recollection of doing it. So it just boggles the mind because of the fact if you're going to find a way to kill yourself that's painless, that's not it. Take all the Klonopin and Ambien together. That's probably going to be way less painful.
I agree. I mean, once she got her hands on prescription meds, that would have been the most painless way. I'm not giving out any type of advice or, you know, please, people, don't do that. You know, go talk to someone. But I yes. tend to think that she would have shifted her thoughts maybe towards, oh, well, what does this do? You know, is this a painless way? I don't know. And then she writes her mom that she's feeling better. Women, they don't normally stab themselves to death like that. Hanging and overdoses and things like that. Guns and knives, not so much.
Plus, she stabbed herself through her clothes. And that's also a big no-no, apparently, when you're killing yourself. And I had talked about it in something last week where somebody had also maybe committed suicide or something, but it was through their clothes. So I had read up on it, and you don't do that.
No, they'll normally raise their shirt or strip down before they start something like this.
Yeah, I don't know why they do that.
Clothes are complicated. And, you know, it just things get caught up in clothes. Where the mind goes when you feel like you're helpless and your back's up against the wall, the mind will wander. But in a lot of situations where people want to end their lives, they take their clothes off. It's just strange, but it's a thing. And, you know, again, I know this is it's a tough subject. I mean, if anyone out there is feeling depressed or like they need help, please reach out to someone. You know, don't take this avenue. Just remember, it's a temporary inconvenience. What you're feeling will pass. You know,
yes.
Tomorrow you may feel differently. So hold off on any type of self-harm.
Could not have said that any better. Also, you know, the door lock or whatever, there's tons of videos on YouTube about how to get through them from the outside.
Absolutely. And there's also, I've mastered it. There's a mechanism of shutting the door and getting those door jams to lock behind you. We used to prank people all the time, especially in high school. You don't need to be on the internal side of the door to get one of those slats to come down. You can make it look like somebody is on the internal side of the door. And when someone tries to come home and use their key to go in and they're locked out. I mean, in high school, it was funny. I wouldn't do it now as an adult, but I'm just saying it can be done. So my question to you is, what does this fiancé do for a living? Is he a
prankster?
He's
a TV producer.
Okay.
You know, he's
so
a TV producer.
Just a TV producer, nothing else. You know, what did he do before that? What did he go on to do? I don't know.
Yeah, I would like to look
to see what he's doing. It's important to the
background. Yeah, I would like to see what he is doing now. I did not look to see what he's doing. I mean, and it obviously the parents are still, you know, on this. That last report was 2017. I think that it could gain some traction. I don't understand at least why the homicide detectives don't want to just maybe take another look at it. But the problem that they're going to have is there's no cameras really inside. It's going to be tough to prove, I guess, beyond
a
reasonable doubt.
The detectives have to build a case. Okay. So if they don't have enough to build a case, I don't want to say they don't want to fool with it, but they do realize it's an uphill battle. And if they have nothing to build on and nowhere to go, then they can't try anyone because obviously the person they're trying is going to get out of it because there's not enough evidentiary support to even take it to a grand jury. A grand jury is going to kick it out before the person gets arrested, charged. You're not going to get anywhere. It's dead in the water. My thing is that who is this fiance to where there's potential cover-ups in the medical examiner's office, potential cover-ups maybe in law enforcement? Who does he know, you know, if he's involved? This is all allegedly. I'm not accusing him, but I'm just saying
exactly. To
blanket the conspiracy theories around this, who is he to where he would get preferential treatment?
maybe it's not even where he would get preferential treatment. Maybe it's just the detectives go, we cannot prove this case. We can't with what we have. Did they check his search engine history to say how to murder somebody, how to stab somebody? Because honestly, 20 stab wounds sounds very personal. If you called it a murder rather than a suicide, you'd go, this is a crime of passion or somebody who has a really personal, you know, thing like this. So I would say that, okay, he would be ripe for it. There's a lot of bad timeline stuff here.
The timeline sucks. He was still in the building. If it's homicide, it's an overkill. The fact is that anyone could have used her computer, and a way around trying to figure out how to cleanly kill someone is to type in things like, suicide, painless suicide. What he's really going for, if he did it, would be non-traceable ways of killing someone and making it look like a suicide. Do you see what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
You can really boggle someone's Google and make it look like it's their idea when it's really your idea, because you're the one on the search engine. He has access to her computer, phone, all that kind of stuff, because he lives in the home with her. And, you know, still none of this stuff explains her anxiety, why she wants to move back home, why she doesn't want to marry him, and the bruises on her body.
Yeah, and he could easily say, you know what, I think I've got a way to kill her or whatever. I'll Google suicide a couple of times. I know how to make this lock. You know, maybe he knows about locked room mysteries, and he knows that she's taken the medication and seen the psychiatrist, and he's a TV producer. So I'm assuming, I don't know, but if he's in Philadelphia, I'm assuming he's probably like a television news producer or something like that. So he probably, you know, sees people, oh, it's a suicide. Why is it a suicide? Well, because they're taking medication, depression, the police will call it a suicide. So that's all he has to do.
He's in any type of programming. I'm with you. You know, he's seen the whole 48 hours, 60 minutes, all that kind of stuff. They've had these type of cases. At the end of the day, police did not have to close this case. Okay. It is not a rush to close cases. They could have left this open. They could have just been, cause of death, stabbing, manner of death, undecided.
Yeah. I'm not saying that he did it at all, but I'm just saying that there are so many questions, and that's why I think that the news media in Philadelphia keeps revisiting it. I think it's why the parents are spending a ton of money with these pathologists and forensic experts, because they wanted because originally it was told a homicide, because that assistant coroner looked at it and said, this can be nothing else but a homicide. But then somehow that was changed. And I get the detectives. They're like, okay, we can't even build a case really. So when we send it to the DA, who's going to decide whether or not to continue move forward with it, they're going to say, no, there's not enough here. We're not ever going to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think even at this point, unless something really, really happens, you wouldn't get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt, because the whole in the room and locked and all this kind of stuff and the medication, which causes suicide, I don't see a prosecutor willing to take that.
Absolutely not. A devil's advocate. If I was his defense attorney, I would tear this department and everyone that came for him up, because they don't have one inkling of support that says that he did it. Yeah, you know, there's no way they could convict this guy. So, I mean, none. That's done. That's dead in the water. There is no justice. And it's not that parents ever get closure. There's no such thing. But they do in time. You know, you get a chance to process. And I just don't think that in this case they'll get the processing that they need and that they want, because, I mean, it is true. There's nowhere to go. You could have a ton of pathologists look at this case at this point.
And yeah,
they say it's homicide. Yeah, and there's still no resolution, because it can't be proven. It look, if it's a homicide, it was clean. The person knew what they were doing.
Oh, all right. Well, that is it for this week. And then we have one more true crime before Halloween. So, everybody, I hope you have a good weekend. And what Jen said, if you are ever contemplating anything like that, reach out to people, reach out to a suicide hotline, reach out to anything. Send me an email. But send Jen an email.
Yeah, hit us up.
Reach out to anybody. Yeah.
We'll make you laugh. Trust me. We're silly. We'll listen. It's temporary inconvenience what you're feeling. Tomorrow you'll feel different. Just ride it out.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, everybody have a great weekend.
Stay positive. A good weekend. Stay safe. Take care of each other.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.